It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We are in Body Week, and the focus is on our digestive system, which, of course, handles the food we eat and where our body absorbs essential nutrients. Call in with your questions about digestive organs, GI tract problems, and colon health, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Poonam Benawal Patel is a gastroenterologist seeing patients with autoimmune diseases at Froedtert Hospital and an assistant professor of medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Dr. Benawal Patel, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So take us on a tour, if you will. Explain first the important steps in the digestive process, what's happening where, starting with the mouth and the tongue.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So digestion is complex and involves many organs, including the liver, pancreas, gallbladder, esophagus, stomach, small intestines, and large intestines. But first, like you mentioned, digestion actually begins in our mouth. When we chew our food, we have production of saliva or spit, which breaks down carbohydrates or starches from the food that we eat. After we swallow, there's a complex and coordinated set of muscles that contract and move our food down our esophagus into the stomach. Once the food is in the stomach, additional digestion occurs. Our stomach lining produces different stomach acids and enzymes, which break our food down even further. Our stomach also has a series of muscles which contract and allow food to turn and to be mixed with these digestive juices. An interesting fact is that solid food actually stays in our stomach for about 2 to 4 hours after eating, allowing for further digestion of contents. So while this is happening, our other solid digestive organs are hard at work. So our pancreas is producing digestive juices that are released into the small intestines. Our liver is producing another important digestive juice called bile, which helps to digest foods or fats and some vitamins, and that is also delivered into the small intestines. So after about 2 to 4 hours of our food churning and being broken down in the stomach, content passes into the small intestines. So the small intestines has three portions. The topmost portion is called the duodenum, and that's where the bile and pancreatic juices complete the breakdown of proteins, carbohydrates, and fats. And then contents moves down through the other two portions of the small intestines. And that's where you have critical absorption of nutrients and water directly into the bloodstream. And then finally, the large intestines or colon is where more water is absorbed and additional nutrients are broken down by bacteria. And ultimately, the undigestible portion is what makes up stool. And on average, it takes about 2 to 5 days from eating food for it to completely pass through our GI tract.
It sounds what you're describing is just like true collaboration in the body. I mean, with all of these aspects, it's like a symphony of digestion, it seems like.
It truly is. And I think, you know, a lot of times we think of maybe one or two organs as being involved in digestion, but really it is a coordinated effort with the function of these particular organs, with whether it's contractions, but also production of critical proteins and enzymes, which are needed to break down food so we can absorb it in a meaningful fashion.
What are in the stomach's digestive juices? What is in that concoction?
So there's a series of different acids, particularly from the stomach, which help to break down carbohydrates, fats, and proteins into forms of the nutrients, which can be digested further on in the small intestines.
We're talking about the digestive system and nutrition. Dr. Poonam Benawal Patel is a gastroenterologist treating autoimmune diseases at Froedtert Hospital. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Something you didn't mention here, hormones. What is the role of hormones in digestion?
So that is a complex question. There are two types of hormones. Like, I'll break it down that way. So there are hormones that are produced by the GI tract specifically, and then there's hormones that are produced by other organs in the body. And to be quite honest, we are learning more and more about how these hormones impact the gastrointestinal tract, and we don't know enough yet to make blanket recommendations. But in general, you know, you want to make sure you have a balance of hormones, which, I mean, that's usually managed by our primary care colleagues.
Is there something that is often misunderstood about parts of the digestive system or the process that you've taken us through?
I think, you know, one important thing that, you know, I get asked about is about kind of gut bacteria. I get asked a lot about, you know, what should my gut bacteria be made out of? You know, what types of things should I do to improve my gut health? So gut health has become a trendy term over the last few years. It's important to remember that many parts of our body, including our skin, has a very large community of microorganisms. Our gut has about 100 trillion microbes. That includes bacteria, fungi, and protozoa. And we're learning more and more that gut bacteria plays an important role in human health. So not only does it break down food to supply important nutrients and vitamins, we're also realizing that there's an important link between gut bacteria and our overall immune system. There have been associations between certain gut bacteria and medical conditions, including mental health, obesity, cardiovascular disease, and neurologic disease. So probably the best way to have a healthy gut bacteria is to make sure that you eat a balanced diet, and then also partake in regular exercise as well.
What can people do to improve their gut microbiome?
So it's important to include foods that are balanced in what we take in. So it's important to take in foods that are low in salt, low in saturated fats, eat plenty of healthy fats, fruits, vegetables, and whole grains.
You know, several probiotic pills are marketed. We've seen, you know, also some types of yogurts on the market to improve your gut health. Do these work?
So there's a lot of ongoing research to understand which bacteria specifically we want in our gut microbiome and how much of that bacteria that we want. Because if you look at healthy people around the world, you'll find that people have different bacteria in their GI tract. And part of that depends upon what we eat, in the environment, genetics. And so the short answer is that there's not one specific probiotic that works for everybody. Making sure that, again, you're getting in a plenty of variety in what you're eating through fruits and vegetables, eating enough fiber, including certain fermentable foods is also a good idea, including yogurt, kimchi, or kombucha, because, again, those are sources of traditionally good bacteria.
So talk a little bit about what happens when we swallow a pill in the digestive system. Like, you know, some people take medications, supplements, vitamins. How are they treated by the digestive system?
They're treated very similar to any food. So, you know, once they're swallowed and enter into the stomach, the acids work and break down the capsule or the outer lining of these medications. These medications have different types of coating depending upon where it needs to be absorbed within the gastrointestinal tract. So certain medications, for example, need to be distributed specifically in the colon. So the outer capsule has to be hardy enough to withstand exposure to all of the acids that are encountered in the stomach and the small intestines. So it really depends on the medication and where it needs to be absorbed.
Frederick Hospital gastroenterologist Poonam Benawal Patel, our guide to the GI tract, how to improve gut health. Call in about digestion issues, questions, gastrointestinal diseases you've encountered, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about the gut microbiome issues related to the digestive system with Dr. Poonam Benawal Patel, who is fielding your questions. Let's go to Vicky in Amherst. Hi, Vicky. What would you like to ask the doctor?
Good morning. I would like her to address, please, a discrepancy I keep reading about with regard to carbohydrates. I have read where we should eliminate all carbohydrates, bread, pasta, rice, all of it. And then I read and also heard the doctor just say that we shouldn't have whole grains in our diet for good digestion. So I would just like her to address that, please.
Thank you, Vicky. Go ahead, Dr. Benawal Patel.
Thank you, Vicky, for that very important question. So carbohydrates are the subject of a lot of controversy and bad diets and discussion. I think the most important thing to remember is that not all carbohydrates are created equally. So just to kind of break it down, there are two general types of carbohydrates. So the first category is what we call refined carbohydrates. So these are foods that are typically sugar sweetened, either beverages, pastries, white bread, foods that are made with white flour. So there have been studies that show that eating a diet rich in refined carbohydrates is associated with obesity and type 2 diabetes. When we do eat refined carbohydrates, we get spikes of our blood sugar, and that can trigger hunger and food cravings. And these carbohydrates are usually lacking essential nutrients. And this is why it's important to minimize refined carbohydrates. On the other hand, there's a category of carbohydrates called whole carbohydrates. So these are minimally processed and they contain fiber that's found naturally in food. So examples of whole carbohydrates are vegetables, quinoa, legumes, whole grains, and oats. So again, whole carbohydrates have many essential nutrients and contain fiber. And there have been many studies that link intake of whole carbohydrates, including whole grains, to improved overall health and lower risk of disease, including cardiovascular disease.
Vicky, thank you for that question. What about foods that help me feel full longer? And what's happening in the digestive system that causes that to happen?
Also a really important question. So when we talk about a balanced diet, we again talk about eating whole grains, but then also making sure that we have enough protein, because making sure we have enough protein prevents those fluctuations of sugar and helps to kind of maintain a more full feeling to reduce craving. So it is important to incorporate lean proteins. So in general, people who do not exercise regularly should be taking in about 0.8 grams per kilogram of protein on a daily basis. Those who do exercise regularly should be taking in about 1 to 1.5 grams per kilogram of protein daily. So the healthiest form of protein are plant-based and include soy, nuts, seeds, beans, and legumes. Lean meat options are also really good options, including skinless white meat chicken or turkey, a variety of fish or seafood, egg whites, or low-fat dairy. I think it's also important to mention that our body cannot digest more than about 30 grams of protein in one setting. So when you do take protein in, it's important to spread it out throughout the day.
Dr. Poonam Benawal Patel with us, gastroenterologist, associate professor at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Let's go to Jane in Suamico. Jane, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a grandson and another person I know who have irritable bowel syndrome. Can you explain what that is and if it's curable?
Thank you, Jane.
Thank you, Jane. So irritable bowel syndrome is a condition impacting the GI tract, and it can manifest in different ways. There are three subtypes of irritable bowel syndrome. So there's the constipation predominant, there is the bloating variant, and then there's the diarrhea variant. We think that irritable bowel syndrome occurs due to a dysregulation or an uncoordinated situation between the nerves of the GI tract and the muscles of the GI tract. And that, we think, results in people having IBS or irritable bowel syndrome. Generally speaking, there's a three-prong approach to treatment for IBS. That includes symptom control. And again, that's if someone has diarrhea, for example, working to change diet and sometimes give medications to help prevent that. The second prong of treatment for IBS is looking at the mind-brain interaction. So we know that there are several studies that show that there is a very strong mind-brain axis. So anything that creates any sort of stress or anxiety or depression can also impact the GI tract. So I often talk to patients about the importance of breathing exercises, mindfulness exercises to help alleviate that. And then the third prong is diet, is working with a dietitian to identify if there are certain triggers for symptoms related to IBS. So that's the general approach that we take with our patients.
Let's go to Andrew now in Green Bay with a question. Andrew, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking the call. I have Crohn's disease. I had some questions about, research and where new medicine is headed. It seems like, every 6 months there's a new biologic medicine. I know those make a lot of money for pharmaceutical companies. I wanted to know if there's anything new coming down the research pipeline. And then also I have two young children, and I know Crohn's disease has a genetic component, and I want to know what I should look for to make sure I'm, have their best interest at heart and any symptoms I should be aware for as they get older.
Yes. Doctor, can you get us up to speed on Crohn's disease?
Yes, and actually Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis is actually a particular focus in my clinical and research practice, so I am excited to talk about this here. So I'll answer your second question first, and that is I want to make sure that people understand that about 85% of people with Crohn's or ulcerative colitis do not have a family member who have Crohn's or colitis. If someone does have Crohn's or colitis though, their child has about a 5% risk of developing Crohn's or ulcerative colitis. And when children are younger, things to look for are diarrhea without any explanation, inadequate vertical growth. So a child who's not growing along the expected growth curve, or a child who's not gaining enough weight. And then also somebody who is anemic or has low blood counts without any other explanation. And then pivoting over to treatments in Crohn's disease, you're absolutely right. We have so many additional medications that we can use to address Crohn's disease now compared to about 20 years ago. There are several different medications coming through the pipeline. The important thing is that these medications work in different ways to address the immune system. And that's critical for our patients because a lot of patients may have response to one therapy for several years and then lose response because their immune system changes. So there are several medications coming through the pipeline, which is great for our patients who need more options.
What might a flare-up be like with Crohn's disease?
Crohn's disease can be tricky because not everybody presents the same way. So in some patients, people can present with non-bloody diarrhea, meaning they're having diarrhea, there's no blood in there. Sometimes people can have blood in their stools. And then sometimes Crohn's can present silently, meaning they don't have any diarrhea. They have ongoing abdominal pain that doesn't have an explanation. They're losing weight or not gaining weight despite trying. And then sometimes patients will present with iron deficiencies or other deficiencies in their blood work, which are otherwise unexplained.
Is there an adequate support network for people dealing with Crohn's disease? Are there support systems for these patients?
There are organizations that are national organizations that have state chapters. So one that we closely work with is the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation. There is a Wisconsin chapter, and they do hold regular workshops and lectures for patients and families who are dealing with Crohn's and ulcerative colitis. And then additionally, at the Medical College of Wisconsin, we annually have a conference which is centered for patients to discuss important issues facing our patients.
Do you find that with Crohn's and, celiac disease, which we haven't mentioned celiac here, but do you feel like there are advancements being made in understanding what could be happening inside the body?
Absolutely. There are ongoing research studies, not only at the Medical College of Wisconsin, but internationally, looking at our immune system and trying to figure out which pathways are activated, which result in Crohn's and ulcerative colitis. It is important to note that, you know, you take 10 patients who have Crohn's or ulcerative colitis, and their immune systems probably are working in different ways to lead to their disease. So we know that there is variations depending upon age, and also race as well, and also where you live in the world. So it is a very complex underlying immune system dysregulation, which we are very, we're really trying to come up with a solution here so that we can eventually hopefully have a cure.
Dr. Poonam Benawal Patel, gastroenterologist at the Medical College of Wisconsin, join in and we'll continue our conversation here on Body Week. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's Body Week here, and we take steps to improve our digestive health and learn what it takes to ensure the GI tract is functioning properly. With gastroenterologist Poonam Benawal Patel fielding your questions at 800-642-1234. Email them to ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Michael in Mequon, who wants to address celiac disease. Hi, Michael.
Hi, good morning, and thank you. About 10 years ago, I had shingles, and shortly after that, I started developing some symptoms, and I was then diagnosed as an older adult with celiac, which means I had the gene all along, but it was activated. Is there any evidence about shingles or other viruses epigenetically activating the genes, and anything new on the horizon for treating celiac other than fully abstaining from gluten-containing foods?
Thank you for the question, Michael. So, you know, we do know that any sort of viral infection or even bacterial infection can set off any sort of autoimmune disease, whether it's celiac disease, Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, so on and so forth. So certainly it sounds like in your case, you know, the shingles might have set off the gene which you already had and then presented with celiac disease. As far as the treatment for celiac disease, like you mentioned, it's completely refraining from gluten-containing products. I would like to first also, just for the listeners, kind of distinguish between celiac disease and gluten intolerance. There is a difference. Celiac disease is an autoimmune disease where your body produces an antibody to gluten and then starts attacking the top portion of your small intestines. It does result in things like iron deficiency, vitamin deficiencies, and can also, in some cases, also present with gastrointestinal symptoms, but not always. Some people have gluten sensitivity where they do not have celiac disease, but they do have symptoms with eating gluten. But it is important for us to distinguish between both of those. As far as you know, new pipelines, therapy coming to the pipeline, there are things that are being tested as far as antibodies, which can be given to people who have celiac disease so that they can continue to eat gluten and also take this medication. But that is all still in research phase and not yet ready for clinical practice.
Michael, thank you for the call. Christina now in Glenwood City. Christina, hi.
Hi there. Thank you. I've got two quick questions and I'll ask them both. I have five family members who've had their gallbladder removed. So I'm wondering what can be done to protect the gallbladder. And then the other question is, I have read that as people age, their stomach acid may become reduced. So how do you determine if you should take the hydrochloride tablets?
All right. One-two punch there, Dr. Benoit Patel.
Thanks for those questions. So as far as the first question is concerned about gallbladder disease and specifically gallstones, there are different types of stones. The most common type of gallstone is actually made out of cholesterol. So in general, making sure that we're all consuming a diet with healthy fats and not unhealthy fats is one way to reduce the risk of developing gallstones and then subsequently having the gallbladder removed. There are families in which you have multiple members who have gallstones, probably due to genetic susceptibilities. So in that case, again, trying to minimize unhealthy cholesterol consumption is really the one thing that someone can do to try to prevent symptomatic gallstones and removal of the gallbladder. And then as far as the second question, there really isn't any large scale evidence that acid production changes as we age. So therefore, there really is no indication or need to be taking any sort of acid supplements as we get older. And I would caution with taking any sort of acid supplement in general, because again, not all acids are created equally. And in some cases, taking extra acids may actually create further issues.
Christina, thank you. Let's turn to colon cancer screening here. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force now recommends people have a colonoscopy to screen for colon cancer starting at age 45. Why get a colonoscopy?
Excellent question. And just a little background information, you know, since the 1990s, the rate of colorectal cancer has been steadily increasing in the United States, specifically in people less than 50 years old. What we do know is that early colon cancer is treatable. We are seeing, again, increased colon cancer in younger patients. We don't exactly know the reason for that. There are several postulated reasons, including a more sedentary lifestyle, obesity, smoking, heavy alcohol use, diets that are low in fiber and high in fat, eating a lot of processed meats. Those may be some contributors as far as why the incidence of colon cancer is increasing in younger patients. And so, like you mentioned, it's important for all people to start colon cancer screening at the age of 45. There are scenarios where people should start screening earlier, including those patients who have Crohn's or ulcerative colitis, those with a family history of colorectal cancer or polyps, and then those who have genetic syndromes, which may increase their risk.
And there's the mail-in test Cologuard produced by Wisconsin company Exact Sciences. Is it worth taking one of those tests if you're younger than 45? What about the mail-in type tests?
So the test that you're referring to is the Cologuard test. It is an option for colorectal cancer screening. It is important to remember that with all of these tests, there are benefits and then potential drawbacks. And so it's important for people to talk to their ordering provider when the Cologuard test is ordered about the rates of false positives, for example, the fact that when something is caught, it could at that point be either an advanced colon polyp or an early cancer. Whereas a colonoscopy, you can really catch these lesions early on and remove them and then be done for 10 years in certain cases.
Talking about the digestive system with Dr. Poonam Benawal Patel, gastroenterologist at Frederick Hospital. Let's go to Scott now in Iron River. Hi, Scott.
Yes, hi, good morning. I developed chronic diarrhea about 9 years ago and went through two different medical systems, including the Mayo Clinic for 3 days and 2017, and was diagnosed with microscopic lymphocytic colitis. And to this point, there really doesn't seem to be a cure. I've tried everything. I have a healthy diet. I exercise a lot, and I work a spiritual practice, and feel like I'm in a pretty good place overall. But so I was just kind of just kind of accepting reality that this is my reality. But a friend of ours who is a retired physician suggested looking into biologic medications. And I ran that past a gastroenterologist up here recently, and he referred me again to the Mayo Clinic. I was going to have a online interview with them, but they told me that they can't do that. They have to see me in person. And I said, well, I don't think so. I don't want to go all the way down there just to see here that there's really nothing more they can do. Mm-hmm. So I opted out. But so this is a very timely program. So I wanted to pose that question to you about biologic medication, what that means. I think the question came up earlier, but I wasn't sure if I heard the answer about biologics. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you, Scott. This is a really important question. So first, you know, lymphocytic colitis and collagenous colitis are two types of what we call microscopic colitis. And even though they're all called colitis, they're not the same. So microscopic colitis or lymphocytic colitis, these are different than Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. That being said, like you mentioned, in some patients, it can be very difficult to treat symptoms from lymphocytic colitis. The first thing that I would, you know, take a look at is to see if someone's on any medications, which could be making lymphocytic colitis worse. The most common example of is something like ibuprofen. If someone's taking that regularly, they should try to refrain from that because that can set lymphocytic colitis off further. The other thing that people should be aware of is if someone has lymphocytic colitis and they're on treatment, but their symptoms still are not getting better, it's important that they're also tested for celiac disease, because patients who have lymphocytic colitis are at a higher rate, a risk of developing celiac disease, especially if symptoms aren't controlled. If all of that's been, you know, looked at and it's still lymphocytic colitis and someone's having significant symptoms, there are occasionally a role for using certain biologics. And here at the Medical College of Wisconsin, we definitely have managed patients with lymphocytic colitis very rarely, but we have with biologics. So that is something which is used sometimes. And we do virtual visits here at the Medical College of Wisconsin. So if that is something that is an option for you, we'd be happy to try to help you out.
What exactly is biologics?
Excellent question. So biologic is a medication that is an antibody to part of our immune system, meaning it's a medication which fights part of the immune system so that the immune system kind of calms down and reduces inflammation. Biologics are larger molecules, so they can only be given through an IV. So, you know, our patient goes in to an infusion center, an IV is placed, and they're given medication through that, or they're given biologics through injections. So they are an immunomodulating medication, which helps to reduce inflammation.
Gastroenterology specialist Poonam Benawal Patel addressing a range of digestive system problems, questions here on Body Week. Still time for yours, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As we learn about gut health, why it matters on Body Week with Dr. Poonam Benawal Patel, gastroenterology specialist at Frederick Hospital. Let's bring in a question from Christine in Green Bay now. Christine, hi.
Hello. Hi. Thank you. Good morning. I'm so happy to be asking this question because it's been bothering me. My son is 11. And he suffers from pica, and part of that is related to autism. About a year and a half, he swallowed two AA batteries that were not of a high quality. They were very malleable. Apparently, he chewed them, and when they passed, they did pass. But prior to that, you know, there was release of the battery liquid inside through his entire system, and they passed within 2.5 days. Mm-hmm. I know there are other parents whose kids suffer from pica, and these things happen. My concern is, what are the potential long-term effects of this situation? the damage that can happen to the digestive system, and his stool has not been the same since this event. So is this something that can regenerate the, is it something that's permanently done damage, or is, I'm not sure how to.
Christine, thank you for Christine, thank you for bringing your story and Pika having an appetite for non-food items. Dr. Benoit Patel.
Yes, thanks, Christine, for the question. And sorry you've been having to go through this. So Pika actually is the craving of ice, which is usually in the setting of iron deficiency. So, you know, it's someone who really wants to be eating ice cubes most commonly. And so if someone truly has pica, kind of by definition, that's really because of iron deficiency. So if that's the case, then that should be worked up as far as why someone has that particular deficiency. And then separately, the ingestion of batteries and other small objects is a concern that we parents all have. And specifically with batteries, it's important to know that if a child swallows a battery, whether it was partially open or not, they chew it or not, that child should be taken either to the emergency room right away, or their primary care physician should be contacted, because there's no way of knowing if the battery were to get lodged in the esophagus or the food pipe, because if that were to happen, then a hole can be burned through the food pipe or the esophagus. Similarly, there can be acid damage to the lining of the stomach. So in general, if someone swallows a battery, they should seek urgent medical care.
Christine, thank you for calling in. Doctor, how does alcohol affect the digestive system?
Great question. And I think a lot of that we're slowly learning more and more about. But it is important to realize that alcohol use disorder has been increasingly rapidly in the United States. And regular alcohol intake can lead to alcoholic liver disease. According to the Centers for Disease, alcohol liver disease kills about 22,000 Americans per year. And nearly 25% of those patients are young. They're in their 20s, 30s, or their 40s. We knew that liver disease deaths from alcohol were already on the rise before the COVID-19 pandemic, but that rate has further increased and spiked since then. And some studies show that excessive alcohol drinking increased by about 20% during the COVID-19 pandemic. So it's important to remember that we really want to limit ourselves. Men should be consuming less than 2 standard drinks in a 24-hour period. Women should be consuming less than 1 standard drink in a 24-hour period. Really, though, it's best to try to choose more alcohol-free days and minimize alcohol use overall.
How much can the liver recover and repair once abstaining from alcohol?
So how much a liver can tolerate is probably different in different people, depending upon genetics, depending upon race and ethnicity. So there really is no standard definition for that. What we do know is that alcohol liver disease does develop slowly, and people can start developing alcohol liver disease well before they have symptoms. So just because, you know, someone says, well, you know what, I feel fine, I don't have jaundice or yellowing on my eyes or my skin, so I should be fine, that actually is not true. And it can present over years and even months. So that's why it's important to take a preventative aspect and really try to minimize our intake as much as possible.
Let's bring in Aaron in Eau Claire. Aaron, hi, go ahead.
I have, my husband and 5-year-old son both have total colonic Hirschsprung's disease, and they both live without a colon. I know that lots of people live without colons in their life. You were talking earlier about refined carbs versus whole grains. Have you found that your patients living without a colon digest the refined carbs better, like it's easier on the gut? I want to make sure that my son gets the best nutrition to grow, but whole grains seem harder on his short gut system.
Great question. You know, I think it's important to realize that Most of our carbohydrates are actually broken down in our small intestines. So just like you mentioned, people can easily live without a colon. People who have had their colon removed for various reasons often do have to be on modified diets when it comes to carbohydrates, because eating a certain amount of certain types of carbohydrates can then result in more diarrhea and GI symptoms. So in general, I would say, you know, it's important for patients without a colon to work very carefully with their dietitian and make sure they're getting a mix of different types of carbohydrates, but also not taking in so much where it's resulting in gastrointestinal symptoms.
Erin, thank you. Irene now in Delafield. Irene, what's on your mind?
Yes, I have experienced extreme bloat and flatulence after I eat, and still, you know, it'll taper off, but it's very uncomfortable, and I was just wondering, how can I reduce the amount of gas and flatulence?
Good question. So, you know, first, it's important that your primary care team make sure that you don't have an underlying autoimmune disease like celiac disease. But aside from that, gas production, bloating, and flatulence all really relate back to our gut microbiome and also what we're eating. So I would say it's important to take a look at kind of what you're eating, figuring out if there are certain foods that you're taking in that are resulting in more symptoms. So common foods that can result in more bloating are sugary foods. So some of those, again, refined carbohydrates that when they're broken down by the bacteria in the small intestines do tend to produce more gas, which can then result in symptoms. There are also healthier foods such as broccoli, onions, garlic, which are also more gas producing. So again, working with a dietitian, your primary care team, to perhaps identify certain foods which are resulting in symptoms is where I would start.
We have less than a minute left. What would you consider to be the one thing a person can do today to help improve their digestive system?
Oh, that's a hard question. So it's one thing I would say. I would say there's like a three-pronged thing that you can do. And one is to, again, look at what you're eating. Try to keep it as well-balanced as possible, as we have alluded to earlier in the talk, with different types of fibers, fats, and proteins. And also participate in regular exercise as well. Even walking at a brisk rate is also important, which does impact gut health. And then finally, trying to minimize alcohol intake.
Trying to minimize alcohol intake. And, you know, there's the line, everything in moderation when it comes to food. What does our digestive system think of that line?
I think our digestive tract actually agrees with that. We have to enjoy life. And of course, if you have certain medical conditions where it's dangerous to be eating certain foods, you definitely want to stay with that, away from that. But, you know, it's really what you're doing most of the days, not the one or two days that you're, you know, eating more fun foods that really counts more. So again, just being balanced, everything in moderation, like you mentioned, is probably the best approach overall.
Dr. Benawal Patel, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Poonam Benawal Patel, gastroenterologist at Froedtert Hospital and an associate professor at the Medical College of Wisconsin. And for disclosure, Froedtert Hospital and the Medical College of Wisconsin are business sponsors of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.